Hello all and welcome to Retail Recovery, a series of podcasts brought to you by Charles Wraxall Speechleys. My name is Caroline Greenwell. I'm a lawyer in the Disputes Division of Charles Wraxall Speechleys and I head up the firm's consumer brands campaign.
And my name is Freddie Law. I'm an associate in Charles Wraxall Speechleys commercial team with a particular focus on the retail and food and bev sectors. So I may be biased and I know I'm talking to a favourable audience, but I definitely think they're the most interesting and exciting sectors to be in. And so I'm really looking forward to co-hosting this series with Caroline.
Totally agreed. So just to provide some context, we have devised this series of podcasts, the detail of which Freddie will come on to in a moment, as a way of imparting some of the knowledge that we as a firm have built up over many years of acting in the retail and hospitality sectors. And we really hope that that will come into its own during the current challenges and beyond. COVID-19 is obviously having a huge impact upon these sectors, but we're really keen to communicate that whilst there is a ton of advice and assistance we can provide in reaction to that impact, there is going to be a world after COVID-19. And we really want to be able to guide and support brands into that world with all of the tools and the experience that we have. It's important to mention that experience is legal as well as non-legal and comes from contributors with a variety of different backgrounds. So we want to keep the series informative yet practical, and we hope that the insights and case studies that we're able to provide will really help you to navigate your way through the challenges ahead and position yourselves as effectively as possible for recovery and the future.
So yeah, that's the purpose of the series, and I'm going to just touch on the format and the structure. And the way we're going to do this is we've split the series into 7 podcasts, and each podcast will discuss different issues and the themes that will impact the sector, with the intention that there will be some key takeaways and lessons for our listeners to use and to enable them to respond to the challenges and opportunities that may lie ahead, both during and in particular after COVID-19. So to run through the podcast in turn at a high level, we're going to start with insolvency and administration proceedings. I appreciate this may not be everyone's favourite topic and one that they desperately want to avoid, but it's clearly very important and unfortunately very relevant right now, especially with the recent news about CAF Kidston and Debenhams administration. It shows that it is really important to be on the ball with this issue and being alert to the issues that may arise may well be the difference between survival and going bust. The second podcast, we'll be looking at employment issues. We'll be looking at the new government measures and guidelines that have been introduced, for example, in relation to furloughing employees. But we'll also be looking at other measures that employers might want to rely on, such as sending their employees on secondments to essential suppliers, such as supermarkets. We're going to have a podcast on how to manage disputes and litigation that may arise in these uncertain and difficult times, for example, where suppliers cease to supply products or customers cease to pay for those products. And we'll be looking at previously unheard of concepts like force majeure and the doctrine of frustration to see to what extent they can be relied upon in these contentious, if any contentious proceedings should arise. We're also going to look at, discuss and consider the e-commerce world. Clearly, getting online is more important than ever, as this may be the one revenue stream available to businesses right now, especially for those bricks and mortar businesses that are seeing their footfall drop in their shops and stores. The opportunity of selling their products online is very important. And we're going to be analysing trends and concepts such as omnichannel and digital transformation to establish how businesses can boost their online presence and revenue without harming or impacting their brand and customer service. And we'll be also looking at how they can mitigate against the key legal risk with boosting and upgrading digital infrastructure. But we're not only going to look at the online world, we're also going to look at the bricks and mortar itself and whether or not organisations should be reviewing their real estate portfolios and what key issues need to be considered right now. And we'll be looking at this from the landlord, tenant and investor's perspective. We'll also have a think about what the future might hold and whether, for example, the days of the commercial office are now numbered, given that so many people are used to working from home. Of course, no conversation about the retail and food and bev sectors would be fully complete without talking about brand protection, and we'll be considering whether or not organisations should be reviewing their portfolio of trademarks, other rights right now, and also with Brexit on the horizon. Brexit is clearly not going away, and it's still going to be a very important and topical issue, as it may radically alter how organisations go about protecting their brand. And finally, the final podcast of the series will be on climate change and sustainability, and how that is impacting the sector both now and going forwards. Understandably, many organisations may have taken their eyes off the ball on this one, given COVID-19 and its implications. But sustainability and climate change is clearly a critical issue that is going to impact us all. And we're going to be diving into the detail on this and considering whether, for example, global supply chains will now be shortened and whether consumer preferences may change for good in light of these issues. So hopefully all our listeners will agree that these are an interesting range of topics that will be useful to hear about. And I hope that you join us as we discuss them.
So that gives you hopefully a good idea of what's in store for the series. As Freddie said, we hope that you'll find it interesting, thought-provoking, and most of all, helpful. If there are elements that you'd like to hear from us on as we go through and you're not sure that they're going to be covered, then please do say. And equally, if any topics strike a particular chord with you and you'd like to discuss it further with one of the podcast team, then we'd love for you to reach out for us and keep the conversation going. The way to do that is by email to retailrecovery@crsblaw.com. So thanks ever so much for listening to the intro, and we're really looking forward to having you with us. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us for episode one of Retail Recovery. In this session, we're going to be considering issues of insolvency, restructuring, and directors' duties in light of the very apparent difficulties that retailers and brands are facing due to the closure of high streets and the impact of other governmental interventions to help control the pandemic. So to help explore these issues, I'm very pleased to be joined by James Hine, Roger Elford, and Dan Moore from our Corporate Restructuring and Insolvency team. A very warm welcome to you all. So the plan is to discuss, amongst others, the duties that company directors are under and their relevance in these uncertain times, how those directors of distressed companies should be looking to protect themselves, the kind of restructuring options and processes that are available to distressed brands, the relevance of the government's response to issues of insolvency, and then finally to have a chat about real life examples that the guys have seen over the last few weeks, and they'll be sharing some practical and commercial tips with us. So without further ado, let's dive in. Could we first of all start with a bit of an outline of directors' duties, both insolvent and insolvent scenarios? I think that's probably a good place to start.
Thanks, Caroline. It's James Hine here. Directors' duties, solvents and insolvents. I think the easiest way to approach it is to say that the directors' duties, and early on to say there is no distinction made at law between executive and non-executive directors. The duties of directors, put simply, are to act in the best interests of the company. Now, there are codified specific issues to consider under the Companies Act legislation. Directors have to avoid conflicts of interest, act with care and skill, etc., etc. But I think the easiest thing for our audience to remind themselves of is that they have to act, if they're a director, in the best interest of the company. And in solvent times, that usually means the shareholders. But in insolvent times, or times of financial difficulty, or what we often call the zone of insolvency, when companies aren't necessarily insolvent, but there is financial distress, then the duty to act in the interest of the company means effectively looking after the interests of creditors rather than shareholders, which would be the case in solvent times. But if the company is in the zone of insolvency, then yes, first and foremost and absolutely paramount must be the best interest of the company, which in these times means its creditors if the company is in financial difficulties.
I think it's worth noting in the current time, current climate, the question as to when a company is solvent or insolvent is going to come into very sharp focus, because solvency is generally measured on two levels. One is a balance sheet test, where a company's balance sheet assets are exceeded by its liabilities. The other one is an inability to pay debts as they fall due. And particularly in this food and beverage and retail sector, with shops being closed, companies are seeing an immediate pressure on cash flow. And those companies without reserves of cash or a reliable funding line from a bank or other investors are going to quickly find themselves in this zone of insolvency that James is talking about, by virtue of being unable to pay their debts as they thought you.
There are some generic things that directors and those involved in the management of businesses in these times should be doing. First and foremost is continue, and a lot of these are obvious, but are incredibly important, especially if anything, any behaviours are challenged further down the road. So it's all about having records in a paper trail of the decisions that were made, upon what information, and just to demonstrate that the directors have been acting reasonably and responsibly. Now, that doesn't mean that directors are expected to have a crystal ball, and the courts are very reluctant to jump in and look at things with retrospect. But the best and most important advice in many cases that we give companies in the zone of insolvency or in these difficult times full stop is to have regular board meetings and have them minuted. Make sure those records are up to date and that they demonstrate that the directors are aware of their duties, and if the company is facing potential difficulties, it doesn't mean it's hopelessly insolvent or definitely insolvent, but that you're mindful of your responsibilities under the Companies Act, that there is reference to financial forecasting. And in relation to that, you may directors of a company may well need to engage professional advisors. In the word insolvency practitioner scares a lot of people off, but they are accountants used to dealing with entities in distress, and certainly the ones that Charles Russell Speeches Act with and for are very constructive in that way. So that is an important part of someone's artillery, is to have that access to professional advice and show that they've taken it, should that be the case. But minutes, financial forecasting, contingency planning, and just having a note of the decisions that you made and the basis upon which they were made. And if required and if appropriate, if it's done in accordance with professional advice, lawyers and accountants, then that will stand you in good stead in a year or two for something to occur and someone to start asking questions as to why you took these steps that you did in relation to the running of the business.
Sounds like excellent advice, and not to kind of scaremonger at all, but were a company not to follow that kind of advice and to take those steps, what sort of risks are they and the directors faced with?
I mean, it's really an evidential thing, and first of all, you're right. Unfortunately, a lot of this podcast might come across as doom and gloom, but I think the way we operate is we hope for the best but prepare for the worst. The effect of not having those documentation or that paper trail, as I call it, is twofold. First of all, directors need to be doing this in order to understand what's happening with their business. So it's a very practical current tool, and they should be doing as best practice anyway. The second point is a bit more pragmatic, which is if a liquidator, an administrator, or a third party questions conduct further down the line in the future, to look back in a year or two, even if the director made every appropriate measure and forecasting and everything else like that, in a year or two, trying to prove that evidentially will be very difficult. So it is an evidential trial. And again, forgive me, it sounds all doom and gloom and everybody's going to get sued. They're not. All we are doing is advising people to take appropriate steps in accordance with their duties under the Companies Act and Insolvency Act. And a lot of it's common sense. Have your paper trail, have your evidence, apply your mind to the relevant issues, which are first and foremost financial forecasting and understanding how the business short to medium term future is looking.
And to what Roger and James both said, and to underline the importance of having an idea of when that duty will shift from promoting shareholders' interests to the creditors' interests. The Court of Appeal has looked at this recently within the last 12 months, and they're moving in the direction of that shift taking place sooner rather than later. So a company doesn't necessarily need to be insolvent on a balance sheet basis or necessarily on a cash basis if the directors know or should know that the solvent, that is starting to be the test. And whether they know or should know is looking at the idea of a real prospect or a reasonable likelihood. So you can find yourself straying into that zone of insolvency that James referred to, where the duty shifts very easily. And in this market and the distress we're seeing from COVID, most businesses really should have that on their agenda and discussing it at board level.
Really good point, really practical point. Thank you, Dan. I just wondered if we could do maybe a little bit of myth busting around the sort of common restructuring insolvency options that there are. I'm sure the listeners will have heard all sorts of terms in the press, and there are some companies that obviously are finding themselves in particularly difficult times. I wonder if we could just very quickly run through the options and processes that are available and that some companies are undergoing currently.
The main one we'll see, Caroline, in relation to retail and food and beverage market particularly, is administration. Administration is commenced either by the directors of the company or by a lender who has certain security over the company's business to place a protective wrapper around the company to put it into administration. Upon entry into administration, there is a moratorium that comes into place which prevents creditors and other stakeholders from taking action against the company or its assets whilst the company remains in administration. The purpose of the administration has to be undertaken by the administrator, the insolvency practitioner, appointed to act as administrator. And they have to conduct the administration with the primary objective of either rescuing the company as a going concern or achieving a better realisation for the company's creditors than would have been the case had the company gone straight into liquidation. So it's really, first and foremost, supposed to be used as a rescue tool, hence the reason why it's being banded around so much in the current climate. And the questions are being asked whether you can have a very sort of light touch, hibernation type administration process by where the company goes into administration, doesn't trade for the next 2 or 3 months, and then resurfaces as a solvent entity afterwards, having used the administration process to prevent creditor action in the meantime, which is something we'll come on to at the moment. At the moment, creditors are largely free to continue enforcement action, notwithstanding the government's stated initiative of trying to protect businesses from hostile creditor action. And administration itself can be coupled with other procedures such as company voluntary arrangements, CVAs, where companies will put proposals to their creditors, whereupon a majority of at least more than 75% of unsecured creditors can vote in favour of proposals or see a company restructure its debts and affairs in order for it to return itself to solvency following a period of distress, as many companies are currently facing. Liquidation is another option in some cases in the current climate, although liquidation itself is generally a terminal procedure resulting in the closure of the business where it can't be rescued. Some insolvency practitioners are currently advocating liquidation for certain businesses, and I've seen in recent weeks the use of liquidation for hotel businesses where it's necessary to just simply shut the business down for the duration of this COVID-19 crisis, whereupon a liquidator may well be able to sell the assets, the hotel itself, the building, the bricks and mortar to a third party who will then be able to start a new business up. But liquidation doesn't generally offer the same continuity of business that administration can provide. Although in the current climate, continuity of businesses is very difficult in retail, food and beverage sectors, simply because businesses are unable to trade. They've been stopped by the government from trading in many cases.
And on that point, Roger, I think just going back to administration, obviously we're seeing in the press the likes of Carluccio's, who have been in financial problems for a while, but they're actually in administration, and the administrators are exploring this idea of informal mothballing, using the administration process and taking the benefit of the government support, such as the job retention scheme. So we'll see how that one plays out, but it's obviously very relevant to the food and beverage sector.
Yeah, Dan, and the court, of course, ruled over the weekend that it was open to administrators to make use and utilise the furlough scheme, and that they would not be deemed to adopt or become responsible for employment contracts of those staff who have been furloughed until such time as they were able to seek recovery of those wages and salary from the government scheme. So protection for administrators who want to use the furlough scheme to suspend effectively the employment of large swathes of employees during the COVID-19 crisis.
Roger, as it just occurs to me that as a lot of the clients and contacts listening to this podcast, not all of them, but certainly retail and others, will have premises, and they will be tenants of commercial premises. Now, we don't want to step on the feet of our colleagues who will do something on the real estate front there, but it's probably also worth mentioning, Roger, and this is certainly your area of expertise, but just the availability for non-payments of potential remedies and LPA receiverships and what winding up petitions, what could happen if there is quite a trend at the moment of tenants just not paying. So is it worth just touching upon where tenants in capacity as tenants rather than landlords would stand if they have difficulties paying their rent?
Absolutely, James, thank you. I mean, in the past 2 weeks, the majority of my work has been talking to retail tenants about exactly that. What they can do to protect themselves from hostile landlord action. And the March quarter day came and went, and many, many, many retailers and food and beverage providers simply could not pay their rent. And landlords then have to look at the options they have in relation to recovering that rent. It's the usual cat and mouse between landlord and tenant. The government moved very swiftly by introducing Section 82 of the Coronavirus Act 2020, in which that provision prevents landlords from exercising a right of forfeiture for non-payment of rent under a commercial lease. That prohibition extends up until the end of June of this year and may well be extended if the current lockdown continues beyond that date. However, what that legislation doesn't do is prevent landlords from relying on their entire range of other options for enforcing non-payment of rent against commercial tenants. And the main one we're seeing at the moment is the use of winding up petitions and statutory demands against companies for failure to pay the March quarter's rent. And the winding up petition procedure can be used against any debtor who owes a debt of more than £750 on an undisputed basis. And the effect of that, particularly with rent, is that rent is generally an undisputed debt payable immediately under the terms of the lease. And so many landlords are taking advantage of the winding up petition procedure in the absence of being able to forfeit and using winding up petitions as a lever to procure payment of rent from tenants. The use of petitions in this way is commonplace in any event, but it's been highlighted following the curtailment of the use of forfeiture. And essentially, the issuing of a petition and its advertisement, which is a prerequisite following service of the petition, can result in both the companies, the tenant companies, bank accounts being frozen, and also puts the world on notice that the company is in difficulty, and that can have massive implications for its banking and other covenants. And therefore, the presentation of a petition can prove to be an incredibly troublesome procedure for any defaulting tenant, and therefore it's a very strong lever for a landlord to use.
I would also just add on to that, Roger, and this isn't restricted obviously to landlords, but winding up petitions at the moment can be presented. They're not subject to a restriction if there is an undisputed debt of more than £750. So winding up petition from aggressive creditors could occur. The legal implication of the actual, not just the threat or a statutory demand, but the actual presentation of a winding up petition, as Roger has said, triggers all sorts of issues. It also might mean that if a creditor is pursuing the business that aggressively and the business isn't in a terminal decline, the protection afforded by an administration and the moratorium on legal proceedings, which include what winding up proceedings, would be very helpful and may well be an option that has to be considered by the company as at that stage if it can't otherwise deal with the petition. Once a petition, winding up petition has been presented, the directors can't make an out-of-court appointment. There are still ways to do it, applications to court and otherwise, but it's just something to be aware of, that if there is a winding up petition being threatened, then as a last resort, you may want to look at administration, which provides this moratorium, this force field against legal proceedings, to give the company some breathing space and to think about an exit plan, which may well be coming out of administration and returning to trading. It may well be coming out of administration and compromising with creditors under a company voluntary arrangement, which requires 75% of the creditors in value to agree to that proposal. Or it might be moving to a liquidation. But if there is a viable business and there is a troublesome winding up, creditor threatening winding up proceedings, then it may well be worthwhile just taking advice on whether administration is an option.
James, just to underline the importance of that as well, what we're seeing in the market is many landlords are taking very aggressive stances. So it's just one for tenants to be aware of, as the landlords are trying to bounce them into paying all of the rent that may have fallen due on the March quarter date. And sometimes that simply isn't the best option for the business. So as James said, there are other options that are available. But we are aware of landlords always taking a short-term approach and trying to get as much cash as they can now, as they see it effectively as a race to get the cash before the winding up procedure is stopped by the government, or at its worst, tenants and businesses simply run out of cash and can't pay. So it's quite a high-pressured environment.
Yeah, and as I said before, it's often coming from landlords, but it could be suppliers, it could be any other creditor for an undisputed debt of more than £750. Moving slightly back, I guess, I think one thing we do need to touch on when we were talking about directors' duties and is the suspension of wrongful trading provisions.
Yeah, it's something that's coming up a lot. Obviously, we've had the signal from the government that Section 214 of the Insolvency Act 1986 relating to wrongful trading will be suspended. We haven't had the final details of that in terms of the actual regulations that will be produced, but obviously everyone's factoring it into their decision-making process quite rightly. It's obviously a very helpful development. It's effective from the beginning of March, and we understand that it will run until the end of May. And obviously it gives directors comfort that potentially during that period, their decisions won't be attacked as wrongful trading, which is obviously a big concern for directors and boards if there is no reasonable belief that the company can continue to trade without going effectively into an insolvency process. So it's very, very helpful. But at the same time, it's really important to understand that the body of case law and statute relating to directors' duties has not been relaxed and remains in place. And that can still lead to personal liability for directors. So everything that we've been speaking about to date is still live. Directors need to execute their decisions and decision-making processes with due regard to their duties as directors, which will be unaffected by the changes to wrongful trading.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I think what I want to emphasise on here is, yeah, much has been made of the suspension of the wrongful trading provisions, wrongful trading being where the company was allowed to continue to trade with, where the directors knew or also reasonably concluded that there was no prospect of avoiding insolvency. If a director is found guilty of wrongful trading, they can be made personally liable for the debts of the company. Obviously, it's something of concern, and the public policy, understandably, behind the government suspending this is in these very difficult and uncharted waters. They did not want directors pushing their company through insolvency because they were scared of being accused of wrongful trading and therefore attracting personal liability. So that is to be welcomed. Pragmatically, though, as lawyers within the contentious insolvency in particular, wrongful trading prosecutions were relatively rare anyway. And it's absolutely vital the directors are aware, as Dan has alluded to, that they can still be made personally liable for the debts of the company in other ways. Admittedly, rare, and there has to be essentially a breach of duty. But wrongful trading, that specific provision under the Insolvency Act, yes, that has been suspended. But all other duties under the Companies Act remain, as does the rest of the Insolvency Act 1986, as does the ability to be disqualified under the Company Directors Disqualification Act 1986. So wrongful trading, yep, that's been suspended, but directors still have a fiduciary duty to the company, which means its creditors. And there is a nasty provision widely used by insolvency litigators, which is Section 212 of the Insolvency Act, misfeasance. And that's where a director is guilty of a breach of fiduciary or any other duty, and then they can be made personally liable. So that's incredibly broad. So again, it all comes back to acting in the best interest of the company, recording your decisions, financial forecasting, and taking professional advice. Yep, we can relax a little bit as to forecasting and whether certain companies should continue to trade, but all the other potential routes into personal liability for directors for breach of duty do remain. I would also, sorry, just tack on there, beware of deposits and trust accounts. If you are holding trust accounts, it's a pretty obvious point, but we do get advice on it in these difficult times. Trust accounts are not a company asset. They cannot be used for companies' working capital. So if you're holding deposits, make sure whether you're allowed to use them as working capital or whether you are allowed to, or whether you are required to hold them in a separate trust arrangement, and they are not to be used for the company's working capital, because that of itself could lead to a breach of trust.
James, on that point, so that reminds me, and it's something that we're both advising on and everyone in the group's advising on, in relation to working capital, the COVID crisis has basically smashed wide open everyone's working capital models. So I think a lot of businesses in many sectors were relying upon their trading receipts to fund their working capital, and that simply evaporated overnight. So they're looking at scenarios where they've got no income and effectively no working capital. So obviously there's a big scramble to get money out of the banks, but until that money comes through, directors and boards need to be very careful about how they treat the remaining assets, that whether that's a cash reserve or fixed assets on the balance sheet, because the working capital models are changing everywhere.
Lots to be mindful of then, quite clearly. And as you said, some relaxation of some of the issues, but very much not possible to take your eye off the ball. And we're definitely hearing that loud and clear. So thank you. I guess just to wrap up, I wonder whether you might be able to share some kind of practical real examples that you guys have been advising on. Obviously, we would have to anonymise them, or particular cases that you've been watching in the press that you think demonstrate some of the points that we've been discussing therefore. Yeah, again, just throw open the mic to any particularly practical or commercial tips and examples that we're seeing at the moment.
Well, I've been advising a luxury retailer who have traditionally had very strong sales in the markets you might expect, London, Hong Kong, Paris, New York. Their products are manufactured in Italy, which obviously was one of the first countries to get hit badly by the COVID crisis. So their manufacturing went down about 8 weeks ago. Their stores promptly closed thereafter. They have massive rent bills. They have a very small online presence and are very reliant on their shops to fund the bulk of their turnover, and they can't get any stock. So over the past 8 weeks, or 3 or 4 weeks in particular, we've been negotiating with their landlords for rent holidays or rent deferments, and also negotiating with their existing lenders as to whether they will continue to fund the company during the current crisis. Practically speaking, the banks have been very slow to react in some ways, very reluctant to put more money in, sort of waiting to see what's going to happen. And so in some cases, we've had to force the issue with the banks by telling the directors to go and seek advice in relation to the viability of their business, which is what banks actually often do in these circumstances themselves. They will appoint an independent accountant to go in and prepare a review of the company's business. But in the present climate, where banks have been bombarded with these sorts of requests, we've sort of told directors to take the initiative and get a report that shows quite starkly what the consequences might be for the bank in the event that the company is allowed to fail. And that has actually helped facilitate discussions and led banks to come back to the table and speak more meaningfully with boards of directors about what their needs are over the next couple of months in order to ensure their survival. But that's just one area where we've been able to accelerate discussions with banks, as well as keeping landlords at bay, at least for the time being.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure ultimately those banks and those landlords, to an extent, will want this brand, this company to continue. So I suppose it's a careful balancing act, isn't it? Because, you know, they don't want vacant premises. They do want recovery to be possible to an extent. So I imagine you've got a kind of a careful balance to achieve there.
Yeah, I'm absolutely right, particularly on the landlord and tenant front. The best advice for landlords and tenants must be that they should just try and work together to find a solution that is no doubt going to cause pain to both parties, but ultimately will result in landlords maintaining their tenants and tenants maintaining their property.
I think that's a really pragmatic bit of advice there, Roger, because obviously it goes for creditors who are pressing for payment anywhere. Communication is key. If creditors get ignored or rebuffed and they don't know what's going on to force the issue, they may move to legal enforcement or winding up. So insofar as it is achievable, keep in contact with your creditors, suppliers, landlord, whatever other issue that you're facing financial pressure from. Because burying head in the sand is not in keeping with your duties as the director, and it's not going to help and could have an adverse reaction that could be avoided.
I think that's right, James. And actually, we have seen lots of retailers just write to their landlords and say, we cannot pay. And landlords, understandably, have written back and said, well, demonstrate you can't pay. You know, you're telling us you can't pay, but you had a pretty good year last year. You paid some dividends to your shareholders, et cetera, et cetera. So in certain cases, we've advised companies to provide financial information to their key creditors under the cover of non-disclosure agreements, but in order to demonstrate the genuine cash flow crisis that a lot of these companies are facing, in order to demonstrate to creditors that this isn't fobbing off or an opportunistic request for time to pay. It's a very real distress situation.
And those landlords themselves will have their own reporting requirements. So to give too much leeway without any evidence wouldn't be particularly clever on their side also. So I think you're absolutely right. Communication and disclosure where possible has to be key, doesn't it?
That's right. Lots of these landlords are very highly geared, highly leveraged, and they've got their own issues to worry about. I think a number of large institutional landlords get in the press at the moment who are going to the wire. And are in major problems themselves due to the decline of the retail or the bricks and mortar retail sector in general, and this is only accelerating those issues for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's one other point that I just had on that I wanted to bring to people's attention. It won't be relevant to everybody, but in making management decisions in relation to those who are involved in group structure companies, where a company sits as part of a wider group. There may be considerations as to how to allocate financial resources intra-group. This is something that has to be dealt with very, very carefully. I'm thinking of intra-group dividends. Should anybody be in such a position to pay one? But certainly asset transfers, and particularly the assessment of or giving inter-group loans. This may well come up, this allocation of financial resources intra-group may well come up in the current climate. And all I would say is be incredibly careful and remind yourself that as a director, you're not a director of a group of companies. You are a director of specific companies, and each company within a group is its own separate legal entity. So any steps that you take, for example, granting a loan to assist a company, you have to be able to justify why that was in the interests of company A granting the loan and giving that loan to company B, rather than saying it was for the good of the group generally and its survival. No, different creditor groups, different creditor estates, they are distinct and separate legal people. So anything that's to do with allocation and moving resources around intra-group, be very clear. Again, I sound like a broken record. Minutes, have the financial analysis there, and also ensure that if there is any doubt as to whether such a decision could be questionable as being not in the interests of a specific creditor group within that group structure, then do take legal advice, because they are separate creditor estates and you have responsibilities to each individual one.
Really good point. Absolutely catching. Hopefully anyone listening that is in that kind of group scenario. So thank you for raising that one. I'd just like to thank you all for that really informative, interesting and practical session as well. I hope that will be of huge use to those listening. If there are follow-up points, I'm sure I can speak for all three of the guys in saying that you're very, very welcome to contact us. retailrecovery@crsblaw. So any query at all, please feel free to send an email to that, and we'll make sure that it gets sent to the right people. So just a huge thank you from me, and I'm sure all our listeners as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Farah. Thanks all. Hope everybody stays safe.